today's guest is someone who's been on the show a couple of times over the last decade or so, and that's Warren Bennis. Warren is perhaps America's leading thinker on leadership. He's a former university professor, an advisor to five presidents, one of the last of his generation still really active in academia at both the University of Southern California and at Harvard. He's written or edited about 30 books, and his latest is called Still Surprised, A Memoir of a Life in Leadership. And it's interesting, in this stuff his publisher sent me, they said this is his first and only memoir, which I guess on the one hand at 85, that's something, because I think Miley Cyrus has written one, so some people don't wait quite as long. And we're going to talk today about the stories and the lessons of Bennis's life and memoir from World War II to the present. And then we're going to also talk about what I perceive to be a consistent crisis of leadership that, I'll give you a little litany. I think it's resulted in, among other failures over the last decade, Enron-style corruption and collapse. Enron was just the big story. There were many. Ill-conceived, unwinnable, and in at least one case, illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The feeble response to Katrina. The Wall Street meltdown and the Main Street recession. The BP Gulf disaster, as well as if you look not just at those headline-grabbing things, but our inadequate responses to climate change and to diminishing energy and water supplies. And then in this country, failing health care, education, and I would say political and governance systems. And then when you look really broadly at the growing social and economic inequity that befalls this country and the world. Now, so you get what I'm setting up here. We're going to talk at first just... what does one find in the book Still Surprised? What are the stories and the lessons? And then focus on that crisis that I think we face. Warren Bennis is founding chairman of the Leadership Institute at the University of Southern California. He's chairman of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School and a distinguished research fellow at the Harvard Business School and a university professor at USC. He's written, as I said, is up to around his 30th book between writing and editing on leadership, change, creative collaboration. His book Leaders was recently designated by the Financial Times as one of the top 50 business books of all time. And his most recent just out is Still Surprised, A Memoir of a Life in Leadership. Welcome again, Warren Bennis.
Thanks, Terrence. Although I must say your introduction about the problems we're going to get to later had me in deep depression for just a few seconds, but let's get to those before the program ends because they are important.
Very good, very good. I always say that I like listeners to get a feel for the people mm-hmm. behind the ideas and the work. Now, obviously, when the book on the table is a memoir, we're going to, you know, some people come in and all they want to talk about is that issue or something, and I want to get them personal. In this case, the memoir says, you know, says it right there. Now, let me just start off. In this memoir, you say little. It's very brief prior to your World War II experience. Mm-hmm. Why?
Thank you for raising that because it's, I think, something that most readers may overlook, that very question, because most biographies and memoirs spend an inordinate amount of and useful time on the psychological nuclear family. When you think of all the psychobabble about George W., it's all related to George Herbert, and so on and so forth. I'm not, you know, if you look during certain chapters in this memoir, that I have great respect for reflection and psychotherapy and all the rest. But I do think the meaning of role, the significance of role in shaping behavior has been seriously overlooked or not paid enough attention to. And I think for me, growing up feeling rather empty, feeling I was a kind of, as I put it in the book, very ungrown up, nebbishy Jewish kid growing up in a kind of a Depression family in the Bronx. The book, In Concrete, has me in New Jersey. I did spend 7 years of my youth in New Jersey, but it doesn't matter. But they were both pretty similar neighborhoods, actually. So role meant a lot for me, not just later on in my life as a trained social psychologist at all, but because, in my case, role had more to do with affecting my behavior. When I was given those gold bars for a 17-month Boy Wonder, junior officer, Fort Benning, what was called the Benning School for Boys, the infantry school. It was amazing how the very uniform determined expectations toward me, as well as my expectations of how to behave. And the reason I wanted to emphasize that by playing down my early years is not because they were dull or boring alone, although I thought they were. It was because I really wanted to emphasize the significance role. One further little illustration. You probably remember a great man, lots of people 60 years and under don't, named John Gardner. You may well have introduced him.
Yes. Well, I've had folks from Common Cause on many times. Right. And point out, let me just say, the amazing thing about John Gardner, besides the fact that he started Common Cause, was that he was a Republican in a Democratic administration of Lyndon Johnson at a time when that sort of thing happened.
Right. And he was also a mentor of mine, a telephone mentor of mine. And when I got to Washington on occasion, you know, we had lunch together. Very wise man from humble origins, Roman Catholic background. And in the interview that I did with him back in 01, he was 87, he was teaching still at Stanford with a cane, and it was a beautiful sunny day, we were sitting on the campus, and I said, John, given your, you know, you said in just now that you thought you would end your career teaching boring psychology to girls at Mount Holyoke. Well, how did you get from there to here? And he looked a little puzzled, and he said finally, these are his exact words. They haunt me to this day. Said, well, I guess there was some qualities there that life was waiting to pull out of me. Well, think of that. Think of all those possible selves that the philosopher Habermas writes about. But all those possible selves, we never get a chance to try on. And sometimes they work for us, that they're actually bringing out of us a piece that's so congruent with our down deep basic who, the me of us, the character of us, the basic fabric of us. And so life, which I took some advantage of to try different things, pulled out of me some things that really I never knew were there in me. You get the. It's important, I think, to point out also, if I may, Terrence, to our listeners, that it also can work the reverse way. Think of a good friend of mine, and this is not name dropping. He's a man that I deeply admire and respect, and ran the worst campaign for the presidency in 2000. I'm talking about Al Gore.
Al Gore's a friend of mine. We were classmates in school.
Are you really? Yeah, okay, yeah. So he's brilliant, and when you're with him, he's personable and charming. Who was that other guy who ran for president in 2000?
The most striking thing for me about that, about Al Gore's campaign, was the day after the election, the public access station in Los Angeles ran a book interview he had done with Connie Martinson, you know, who does the book interviews here, when he had written Earth in the Balance, his book about climate change, right? And it had only been a few years earlier than his campaign, right? But before before he was vice president.
It was probably.
He was passionate. He was loose. He was there. He was present. And I remember looking at it and saying, why didn't that guy run for president?
Do you remember his answer?
No. I said to myself.
Oh, you said to yourself.
Why didn't that guy?
Yeah, exactly. See, to use the jargon of the trade, my wife is a retired psychopharmacologist, psychiatrist, neurologist. In my case, most of the roles I found myself in were, quote, ego-syntonic. Putting it differently, they were congruent with one of those Warren Bennis's authentic selves. With Gore, with Al, he was a hostage to his parents' dreams. He was brought up to be president, for God's sakes.
You know, it's funny. I actually one day was watching him. And the way that he stood at a podium and pronounced, sort of, right? And there was a kind of diction even that was different from when you were hanging out with him. And I remember thinking, he's imitating Daddy. Because Daddy was a patrician Southerner.
Yes.
With, that very formalized Southern thing that we last saw sort of in Robert Byrd.
Mm-hmm.
But Al Sr. had a certain formality about him. And it looked like when Al became candidate, he imitated Daddy that he'd seen when he was 4 and 5 and 6.
It must be, I think, yeah, I heard a very corresponding view of the same thing, Terrence. Fortunately, it was Halloween day 2000. And guess who I'm sitting next to by sheer accident from a plane going from Boston back to L.A.? It was James Carville. Now, I didn't want to, you know, he's a celebrity, and I was intimidated by that sort of thing, and I didn't want to, he's probably been, you know, but he just wanted to talk.
And
he
began like James Carville.
Yeah, and he was very interesting in that respect. He said, Gore was the kind of guy who you're sitting in the fifth grade class with. He, of course, has a tie on and kind of a little bit of a blazer, even in the fifth grade. And the teacher forgets to ask for the term papers that were due that day. And Al sticks his hand up and says, you haven't asked us to turn our papers in yet, right? Okay, so there's... So Al Gore... And you have to wonder about this, being, trying to be his parents, his dad's dream, takes on a role that doesn't fit with who this Al Gore really is.
Yeah.
When you see him talk about the Inconvenient Truth, he's a different Al Gore,
that's
isn't
right.
he?
And yeah.
Who?
Yeah.
And is that key? I mean, that statement of John Gardner's, I guess he said, you know, some qualities were there. He doesn't say what there is, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there were some qualities there that life was waiting to pull out of me. Whew. Yeah. So when we talk about inauthentic versus authentic, it may have something to do with what my wife would say. Well, in Gore's case, it was ego dystonic. She said, in your case, happily, it was ego syntonic. I think I know what she means by that. It fits with your basic self or it doesn't.
Yeah. One thing I also wanted to mention is your wartime experiences. And it's interesting because when I interviewed you several years ago about your book, Geeks and Geezers, when I saw you speak the other day about your book, a lot of the time you spend is on your wartime experiences. And I think that was where I think you first found the role that called out the leader in you and so on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that... So tell us just a little bit about that, because I think it is core.
Yeah, well, you got to imagine this. A kid, a Bronx boy, leading a platoon, infantry platoon, just as the most American troops were beginning to move across the Rhine. Now, you know, I wasn't even a Boy Scout. I wasn't even... But there I was and the key thing I remember is that in the middle of the night being shown where my platoon was by the runner. We didn't use walkie-talkies then. We used them occasionally, but rarely. It's the middle of the night, and the runner says, why don't you take my banquette? It was a bombed-out house and no roof, but... Take the banquette. I said, no, I'll sleep on the floor. So I'm awake all night listening to the artillery burst overhead, scared, as you can imagine, and up the entire night, just frightened to my bones. And in the morning, I think it was early, the first light, I hear a voice, who turns out to be the first sergeant, says, ask the runner, who's that on the floor? And he said, that's our new lieutenant sergeant. And I wasn't breathing then. Waiting for his response. And he said, good, we can use him. We can use him. Now, that line, we can use him, because they made me their leader. That's a significant
thing. Well, it's interesting. It resonates very much with what you quoted Gardner as saying.
I guess it does.
You know, that life found qualities it could use. That these people, that if we miss being used well...
Yeah.
Who we have potential to be may never happen.
That's the line that stands out of me, totally unrelated to my book, Cider House Rules. Cider House Rules, right, where at the very end, the doctor in charge of the foster home says to the young boy going out into the world, after being in the foster home so many years, said, and what are you going to do with your life? And he answers with four words. Yeah, four words. To be of use. Okay. In that situation... I have to take a little bit of credit because they didn't come on like an arrogant, you know, Fort Benning shavetail or they'd boss people around. I had enough brains or intuition. So I'm not going to say it's all luck, but this, my platoon really gave me experiences, literally, almost like out of the book, to give me some idea of what it would be. So they had me follow the captain. There were only two officers before me, when in the regular infantry company there would be six. Only two, a guy named Claude Williams from Georgia and Captain Bessinger. Do not, as I say in the book, cannot never even thought
about. You never knew his first name.
Never knew his first name, I guess. Yeah. It's not a matter of recall. It's a matter of, I don't.
Captain Bessinger.
It's Captain Bessinger. And a North Carolina kid who was apparently the caretaker of the Vanderbilt estate in Nashville, North Carolina. And they said, go, just do whatever the captain does. And I followed him. And they knew, they saw me, you know, and they laughed when I got back to the platoon that night. They all began laughing because Captain Bessinger, because for the months, this, by the way, this is a division, Terrence, that had been in combat since probably July of 44. Go back. Since probably November 44, and this now was, I'm sorry, I'm getting my dates confused. Since probably, D-Day was June, probably since around, yeah, July, August 44. They'd been months in combat. These were seasoned troops. And I was called a replacement officer, spec number 1542. I do remember that. Okay, so they had the good sense to train me. I had the good sense to listen.
To let them train you.
Let them train me, you know, yeah, without feeling. And, you know, one of my wise figures and one of my, I think one of the wisest people about writing about leadership, still with us but no longer the head of Herman Miller, is someone you've probably interviewed, Max Dupree.
I haven't yet. I should.
He's amazing, and he's still going, you know, and he's still available.
I've done some work with Herman.
Well, I want to
push it. Enough to do that.
I just want to mention his book. It's remarkable. It's called The Art of Leadership. It's a brilliant, wise book. I don't know of a wiser one, actually.
And not a fat tome.
No,
right?
Very small.
175
about
pages.
That. Even,
yeah,
you know,
something.
Maybe less.
Yeah. It really is. It's the essence rather than the big book.
You know what just comes to my mind? Comes to my mind with a smile. Is the title of his first chapter is "Pink Ice in the Urinal," because he's talking about the stuff that doesn't make a damn, that we put pink ice in the urinals. I mean, he says three very important things in a book about leadership, and I don't mind quoting Dupree. One, first, the main goal of any leader is define reality.
Whew,
define reality. Second, get out of the way. Three, say thank you.
Wow. Okay.
So what did my men do? My men, that was the first morning. They helped me define reality. First of all, they helped me with follow the captain, you know, I mean, see what he does and imitate, you know, do it, blah, blah, blah. And they gave me a lot of, like, not unplanned for. These were all young guys, too. I was maybe the youngest, but the oldest was 32, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And Bessinger, whom I thought was an old guy, I guessed in the book he must be 38 at the time or 35, I don't know. But like that, under 40.
Sure.
Okay. Boy, in a way, I was, without knowing it, taking Dupree well before he wrote that book. He was mirror imaging me, or I was mirror imaging what he would later write. Who knows what goes on.
Yeah.
But the other thing was this, I learned, is how important it is to take care. And this sounds quite almost benign paternalism. I don't care what you call it. But it was to take care of your men. And I began realizing early on that weak, and I observed this in other companies in my same, that battalion, to not take care of their men. A lot of men had been sent back for a thing called trench foot. This was the coldest winter in history, I discovered, the winter of 45 and 44 in Europe. And freezing.
And wet.
And the only way you can avoid trench foot or frostbite is to take care of your feet. No kidding. Here, and what people remember most of all when I talk about my experiences in World War II, is this experience is my, and then I learned from the regimental medical officer, you got to do this, Bennis. He said, make sure that every night before they go to sleep, all of your men dry their feet, put on dry socks, heat them on a fire, because there's not going to be any heat around, and make their feet warm between, make them dry between, watch them, he said, because I don't want to treat these trench foot people because it means going to amputate their legs or arms, for God's sakes. Okay, so every morning, this morning I thought
know.
Of it, thinking I was going to be on your show, I thought about, oh my God, I dry my toes in between every toe painstakingly, like it's out of World War II. But think of that scene of the, and my men did not get frostbite.
And trench foot. Exactly. But here, your story, though, to place this wartime experience in context, your story reminded me of the story of similar beginnings in the life of Howard Zinn and my own father, Howard Zinn, who recently passed away, such a wonderful man and made such a great contribution. He was working on the docks and had no hope of going to college. I believe he was in the Army Air Force. On the GI Bill, he was able to go to Columbia, and his career grows out of that. My own father, who passed away this spring, was the son of a single mother and a mill worker in New Bedford, had no hopes of going to Harvard. He went in the Army Air Force, and after the war, went to Harvard on the GI Bill. Talk a little bit about the value of the GI Bill and its transformational effect on this country.
It's amazing. I mean, it's such a lush question, you know, because there was a time when most of us grew up thinking that government can be a good thing. It almost brings, I get teary a little bit now that you ask me in public what I'm going to say about this, because when I think of the number of young men like your dad, and he and I, he's just he's a couple of years older than I,
One, I think. I mean, he also, you were both officers at 19.
Right. And Zinn, I didn't know about Zinn's, I knew Zinn when he used to teach at BU, because I was, I taught at BU for 3 years, and he was there, he was really the loudest radical voice on campus. You must have interviewed him on this station many times, because he was one of the few voices.
Yeah, no, I've had him only a couple of times, actually, when you're interviewing him, he's present, he's right there.
He's terrific.
Well,
I mean, he is, there are times when I've just, he's one of he's a very unusual guy. And I also know, but less well, his son, who's a Buddhist, well-known Buddhist teacher.
That's his stepson.
Yeah, it's John Cabot Zinn.
John Cabot Zinn. What he did was he took his wife is Myla Zinn.
Oh.
And when John and Myla married, they combined their names. And by the way, folks, I am in conversations right now with John Cabot Zinn. He's coming to town in a few weeks, and he will be on this show. It's been about 5 years since I've had him on. He's going to be on in the next few weeks.
Oh, he's terrific. Well,
yes.
I'm going to tune in. So. And then he's also giving a speech I'm going to go to somewhere.
Right.
Let's see. So
the GI Bill, the transformational value.
Isn't that amazing. So amazing. Because the little backstory is that my runner, whose first name is Gunnar, he was from Syracuse, New York, he was killed in action before the war ended May 8th. And he was always raving about this college called Antioch College. What did I know? Antioch College, nearest city, Springfield, Ohio. But I learned that there they had this thing called a co-op program. Co-op program meant you worked part of the time. So I figured, well, I can work my way through college. Interesting. By the way, not widely known is the state of California, where once I was drafted from California for strange reasons.
Right.
It also had a supplement to the GI Bill. Did you know that? I don't think many people did.
So you got the federal program and you got the state program.
That's right. And think of the fact that I have two older brothers who are twins and never had a chance to go to, partly because of your dad in a way. They were burdened by being 9 years older. They were burdened in a way. They couldn't take advantage of it because they had kids and blah, blah, blah. So they didn't. Whatever they could have, but they didn't. And I can understand why they didn't. Your dad did.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things I want to let people know is that when you went to Antioch in 1947, 49% of the students in college were there on the GI Bill.
Thank you for that fact. It's in the book.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yes. Yeah. And when you see the thing that I mean, I grew up knowing this, and then I've seen it with you.
Yeah.
I've seen it with Howard. George McGovern,
your dad,
also went to college on the GI Bill.
Wow.
That you've come out of a depression where you're not even sure where your next meal's coming from if you're in the working class.
Yeah, right.
And because of the GI Bill, you folks become, college becomes no longer the elite province of the preppy kids or the well-off, but it actually is infused with you. And I just, as you said, you almost got teary thinking about it, that was a time when we thought government could do good.
Yeah.
That generation was that generation, but they benefited from that. And now, there's such an attack on on the and nowadays what you have instead, and we'll get into this later in the second in the second half, but you have so many kids graduating from college with debts of $40,000 and $50,000. They're basically indentured serfs.
They are.
They can't make the bold choice for what they might want to do with their life. They might not be able to ask, what does life want from me? They might say, I've got to pay off that bill. And suddenly we're taking these people and crimping their future, whereas for your generation, we you know.
I think we're going to get to this probably later on, Terrence, but there's got to be something in our collective political makeup which is still keeping us... which is somehow collectively, maybe not even fully... If there is a thing called a collective unconscious or conscious, I think there's a collective unconscious, using an old Jungian term, which has been discredited by just about everybody. I am not discrediting it. I think there's a collective unconscious about keeping the middle class in its place, keeping the lowest quintile, the lowest fifth in its place, and keeping the top 5% in its place. And look at this. I'm totally in favor of a national act which equivalent to the National Service Act, which would give for everyone graduating high school, men and women, whether they were born here or not, to commit themselves toward 2 years of national service. It could be the military. It could be taking care of the elderly. It could be all sorts of service areas where we could really help the underclass get up out of the underclass. And why has that never gotten traction? Even though people, the newly elected Democrat senator from Virginia, who
Jim Webb,
argued for this, it doesn't. You don't even hear about it.
Yeah.
A National Service Act, wouldn't that be sweet?
And Webb, of course, is a veteran and knows.
Yeah.
You know,
so we have a shrinking middle class, a growing gap, chasm between the top quintile and the bottom quintile. And you don't hear anybody shrieking.
And when you think about
the
investment.
Is, why aren't people marching?
Yeah.
Why is it that the very people who are voting for the Tea Party are going to be the most seriously and affected in the wrong way by everything the Tea Party's, the very party that they seem to be standing behind, will do them more harm than even their most wildest fantasies about what this socialist black man will do to us?
Yeah. Speaking with Warren Bennis, he's a university professor and a distinguished professor of business at USC. He also is at the Harvard School, the Kennedy School, and the Business School. And this, by the way, at 85. His newest book is Still Surprised, A Memoir of a Life in Leadership. You can learn more at warrenbennis.com. And you can learn more about the show at terrencemcnally.net. I want to speak to the audience for a second and say that the book, Still Surprised, has some of the same quality that you hear so far in the interview, which is that it is Warren Bennis drawing from his own life experiences and the occasional quote from someone. And the, you know, in other words, you interrupt yourself in the book the same way you interrupt yourself here. And we've gone through half the show. I definitely want to spend some time talking about what I consider our crisis of leadership. So we're not going to spend too much time, much more time on this, but there's a lot of interesting stuff in here. Let me ask you something that's about what you do in the book versus some of the events in the book. You say at the very start, you say that this is a book of stories. One of your quotes is, deftly shaped stories compel an audience as nothing else can. And I was wondering if you were familiar with the set of YouTube clips that Ira Glass has on storytelling. No. Well, then, for listeners...
Well, I've listened to Ira Glass.
Yeah.
I just haven't seen the
But if you want, just, you know, go to YouTube and do Ira Glass and storytelling. There's like four-minute clips, and he really lays it out there. But one of the things that Ira Glass says is that this American Life story consists of this happened, then this happened, then this happened, you know, that sequence of events that you want to hear the next one. But it has to be interrupted every few minutes by the lesson. So that's, and if you look at, he says he started doing this when he was a news producer first, and then it became the, it is, the, you know, you, every This American Life story follows a sequence of events every few minutes. This is the lesson. This is what I've learned so far. This is the message. And Ira says that at one point he thought he was like a brilliant originator until he realized that this is basically the form of the sermon. And that it is, it's been, you know, preachers have done this forever. Story, lesson, mm-hmm. story, lesson. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what this book is. So let me just ask you, pick any one other story in the book and a lesson that came with that, and just share that, and then we'll go into the question of the crisis of leadership.
You know, it's interesting, and I got to put, if you don't mind, a plug in for my university and its new president, Max Nikias, because it's interesting, first of all, that a Greek Cypriot is the president of USC.
Right.
Waspish USC.
Considered the WASP University of the West.
30 years ago, it was pure WASP. And I even felt not at home there 30 years ago. I do very much feel at home there. And why I'm bringing it up now is because Max, himself an engineer by training, is our new president, started a program when he was provost called Visions and Voices, which is bringing together the humanities and the sciences. And Ira Glass was one of the people he had on campus. And I think Ira Glass is going to be there, I think, I'm not sure of this, during Max's inauguration, which is October 15.
That may make sense, because Ira is going to be in Orange County at about that point, and I've contacted his people about having him on the show when he's in town.
I bet that's it. I bet that is that week. Yeah. That's very clever, though, of you both to think about that, and Ira Glass is an example. I guess I didn't realize, by the way, until you said it, that, and I take it as a compliment. One of the things I never thought I was particularly good at, Terrence, is when I used to do a lot of speaking for money. I don't do any speaking for money anymore. I speak pro bono, but I like people to buy the book. And if they have 150 people, that's great.
Yeah.
Each person gets a book, I'll do it for free. Not my usual, still surprised fee that I used to get when it's out there. So whatever the agent, not my agent, but whenever the client to whom I was supposed to give a speech said, "Well, Dr. Venice, what will be your takeaways?" And my stomach would tighten up. I said, "Takeaways? Yeah, you know, your deliverables, deliverables." And I never thought I was good at deliverables or takeaways. But you know, those stories are the takeaways, aren't they? The stories that are the deliverables. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I can just say, well, okay, here's the one that comes to my mind.
Great.
Quickly. It has to go back. It's the first one in the book, really. And it's guided so much of my life since then. When my dad, in 1932, and we were living in the Bronx, we moved to New Jersey the year or two after, 1932, the very depths of the Depression, came home a lot. He was a shipping clerk. And he came home after work one late afternoon or early evening and said, lost his job, quit. He didn't quit. He was fired without any pension, without any health, without nothing. So for the next year or two, he actually loaded illegal booze. This was prohibition.
This is the Depression and Prohibition.
Yeah, the Prohibition was repealed the next year, sometime in 33. This is 32. So he loaded illegal booze on mafiosos' trucks. He ran summonses for lawyers. He gave street money to people to go vote the ticket, whatever the ticket was. That's how and by the way, this is not an unusual story.
No,
this
not
is
at
no
that time.
Poor, this is not a pathetic story that all of us, the rest of us, we were all going through this. And it was a big deal, but I said to myself, and I have two of them, everybody in my family looked helpless. I thought to myself, oh my God, I really felt that first anxiety that I think I've kept a long time. The anxiety of being helpless, the anxiety of being at the effect of someone who could overnight do that to you. Can you overnight take away your livelihood. Overnight, I don't want to give that. I don't want to cede that power to anyone but me. But I want nowadays we use the nice term agency.
Right.
Yeah, I want agency. I didn't, as a 7-year-old, didn't put it that way. But I said to myself, I never want to be in the position my dad was to have someone. And it could be a laugh line. I don't think it is. Is it any wonder that I ended up as a tenured professor? Now, tenured almost virtually means, even the academists thus far, there are no date. You have to, obligatory date, you have to resign. So here I am, a tenured guy. I hope no one is listening too closely from my dean. And, you know, I'm virtually, you know, until something so happens, till I decide, or pretty much, wow, what influenced my dad's
That moment, that day.
That moment, that day.
Yeah. Okay, that's the voice of Warren Bennis. We're talking about his memoir, Still Surprised, A Memoir of a Life in Leadership. And now we're going to shift to talking about leadership. Let me set it up. In the introduction to this show, I laid out a litany of failures over the last decade. Enron-style corruption and collapse. Enron was just the biggest name, but it seemed like, you know, it wasn't just the tech bubble. It was the WorldComs, the Adelphias, and so on. Ill-conceived, unwinnable, and at least the case of Iraq, illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our feeble response to Katrina. The Wall Street meltdown that now has us still so suffering in the Main Street recession. The BP Gulf disaster. And then, as I looked at bigger pictures, we have a feeble, inadequate response to climate change and diminishing energy and water. We're doing too little, too late on all of those. We have a healthcare system, an education system, and a political system that is not serving the people. And then what you were just speaking about, what we've brought up a couple of times, this growing inequity in this country. You said quintile versus quintile. Mm. But if you know, it's much worse than that. It's the top 1% that has made the most. I mean, and it's the lower 4/5 the real wages for normal Americans haven't risen since 1973, and for the top, the people, as I started saying to people over the last 10 years, the people who make money are the people who play with money. You know, there's nothing you can almost do that makes as much money as playing with money, whether they produce anything productive or not. We have these crises now. This whole issue of leadership, how much do you, to me, I look, when you asked the question before, why aren't there marching in the streets over a lack of service, over what's happening in the middle class and so on? And I'm going to set it up with one other thing. You also say that you don't think leadership is about men on white horses and you know, Superman or something like that, that it really is a dance between leaders and followers and so on. But what role does leadership or failed leadership play in what seems to me to be just a very sorry state of affairs?
Yeah, my mind, my brain swims at the question. I think every decade, over the last 4 or 5 decades, I've written a piece called "Where Have All the Leaders Gone?" And it's repeated. I can do it, the same article with just new names, and you wonder. But I think it's a more complicated thing than. Although it is the pivot of it all has to be leadership. Last night, I went to a documentary. I can't give you the exact name of it, but it was about the cover-up of this NFL football player.
Oh, the Tillman. This is the Tillman story. It's
exactly
about Pat Tillman.
The Tillman story. And it's a total cover-up, and we still don't know the truth. I mean, it is the most frustrating. Well, there was no catharsis in the film. It ended not with the culprits not being taken to court, not being charged. We still don't know the whole story. Okay, so there's obviously some collusion here. Who is keeping that story from us? Well, where are all the people who should be deeply concerned? First of all, where are the investigative reporters? Are they somehow not... I mean, I don't get it. There seems to be a vast collusion here, because one of the things that struck me about the film is the pusillanimous, I can't get that word right.
That's right.
The weak-kneed congressional questioning. I thought, the head of the committee is Waxman, I think. So, is that right?
Yeah, Henry Waxman.
I was glad to see him there.
Because he basically has the reputation as the top guy in Congress.
They were maybe, the best I could say of any of the questions, they were cotton candy Larry King, period.
Oh, my God.
They were worse, maybe, than that. They were just nowhere at trying to get through the reality. That's okay. So, first of all, our leadership, and I have to say I'm rooting always for Mr. Obama, and yet his problem right now, I think, is in terms of leadership. He said, look, I want to tell you that I have been a fan of Obama before he was a nominee, and I'm still, my hopes, commitment are still with him. I just want to make that clear. But there are some fundamental errors which he has to face up to. Jonathan Alter put it well in his book, The Promise. Yeah, when he said there are no sound bites to his speeches. Marvelous talks. I mean, magnificent, historically talks that will go down in history. But no punchline, no, he calls them sound bites. What does that mean? Metaphorically, he's absolutely right. Mr. Obama's issues are long-term issues for the most part. They're not issues where people live. Roosevelt, to take him as an example, and Alter's first is the first book I read by Alter. He may have written other ones. Is the FDR story?
The first 100 days of FDR.
And you know, there were something like 60 million people listening to his first fireside chat in early 1933, and there were only something like 29 million radios in America.
Right, right.
29 million radios. And 60 million people gathered around Roosevelt. I don't want to lionize Roosevelt, my God, because I think Obama is much better suited in terms of the basic qualities than FDR, really, in terms of intelligence and temperament. However, he is super, cerebral, and somehow the issues people are hurting are not long-term education, not long-term even health. They're interested in jobs today. Or what Roosevelt did was he created the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, 9 million people hired overnight. Now, okay, you can say, where is he getting the money from? So number one is, I think it isn't just the president. The president has made many errors, including I wish he'd add to that marvelous political staff around him. I think they're great. I'm talking about Axelrod, how do you pronounce his name?
Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah. They're terrific minds, but he needs other sources. In some ways, more of an intellectual. He needs someone, not because I'm at a business school, but I wish he had someone on his economic team, leading the economic team, rather than former President Larry Summers of Harvard. I say that because none of the people on his, there are not enough people to the left of Summers, and there should be, A. But more importantly, Terrence, and maybe you won't agree with this, they need someone who's got the right points of view, but has met a payroll once. Mm-hmm. Now, one of these people, Yvette Bourne, that I know of on the economic team, maybe they brought somebody in recently. Now, I know some terrific CEOs who could be interviewed by you, who have the same liberal opinions I do about a lot of things, and whom he could have called on. And he's not gotten good advice on his economic team. Larry Summers is a terrific brain, but that's what he is.
That's right.
He's not a leader, and he's not persuasive, nor is the Secretary of Treasury not a leader or persuasive. These are people who are in the bleachers. They've been in the bleachers, and they should remain in the bleachers. They've not been fighting the bull, as Robert Graves wrote about Roman leadership, centuries ago. No one has been fighting the bull in the arena of that whole economic team. This is a major problem. So what I'm getting at is there's a collusion here, a weak-kneed Congress. You know, why haven't we had, on the case of the Tillman story, why didn't someone appoint an independent prosecutor to look into that? No, he didn't.
Well, let me suggest an answer.
Yeah,
and I haven't seen the Tillman story yet,
that's good.
I plan to.
It's frustrating.
Yes, I'm sure. But I think he becomes Tillman becomes more heroic in this movie than we ever knew. But I think that what you have is there's a reason that people justify their weak knees, and I think they feel that it is not politically smart to attack the military, even if the military absolutely deserves it. Now, interestingly, in Alter's book, the biggest moment of courage that he paints is when Obama gets tough with McChrystal.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say, other people would say, and then he got tougher when McChrystal was out of line mm-hmm. again. But it's not enough. It's not enough. And I think so I'm saying, I think what we have, and let me ask you about this, because I think we're going to, I mean, this is the, I didn't know that we would end up focusing as much on the political, and maybe we'll get into it, because I think also what we see is the leadership in business so focused on cleverness and greed rather than, something that really serves the bigger picture. But in politics, what I see is you have one party, the Republican Party, that serves the greediest of corporate America, and so when it puts out something it wants, like to keep Bush's tax cuts for the rich, it has no compromise because what it wants is what its funders want.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Democrats put out that they want something else. They want universal mm-hmm. health care. They want improved education. They want more fairness. But then their funders are the same as the funders of the Republicans. So they compromise. They are constantly negotiating with themselves. And America seems to like people who put a stake in the ground and show commitment. So the Democrats, I think, lose on both counts. One, they don't fight for something that they really want because they're split between their own impulse and their funders. And two, they lose politically because people can see through it.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. And I also was thinking about something that I'm sure it's understood, but I'm speaking not for USC or Harvard. I'm speaking here to you because my views are very close to yours. But let me tell you, first of all, the word compromise, I totally got it reframed in a play I saw in London. I don't know why it's never come here. It was about a radical reporter for some English newspaper, The Guardian reporter. His name was Tom something, and Clement Attlee, and it was called Tom and Clement. And at one point, when Tom, the radical writer, was accusing Attlee of being a compromiser, Attlee stood on the desk. I'll never forget this. Says, "Listen to me now, for God's sake," says Attlee, who's uncharacteristically standing on a table shouting at Tom, this journalist, whose name I can't recall. And he says, "Do you know what the word compromise means? It means co-promise. It means promise together. There's nothing wrong with that. The only way we got some form of socialized national medicine here is because of compromise. It would be a non-starter if we didn't move to this in different ways. So, come on." Well, there's some truth to that. And we now have, somehow or another, and I lay part of the blame at our Congress, that the extremes are getting reelected every year, so there are these certain seats that become more rigidified, and why should they not? And these border states are always up for play that have a moderate. Where are the moderates? I think I remember one. His name is Lugar. Wasn't there one? I mean, the commissioners of baseball, they've all gone. Where have all the moderates gone?
Right. No. Nixon was impeached for Watergate, you had Howard Baker, Everett Dirksen, Jacob Javits. You had Republicans who actually seemed to be someone you could co-promise with.
Right, co-promise.
So
it's a systemic thing that has got to, I mean, so therefore, for example, I would think that Mr. Obama has got to take some actions. As one recently came up, I was arguing with my wife about this. I said, so he should do it without... when the Congress is in recess, and let people boil about it later. He's got to take actions which are going to lower his approval rating, but at the worst, he'll go down in history as one of the best first single-term presidents we've ever had. But if he does the right things, bold acts, which may drop his approval, he will have to do things that will break into this really sick, not compromising, but sick collusion of people keeping things at a stasis.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And when you see that collectively, you have to say, someone's got to unlock that gridlock. And that means here's where the president may have to take bolder steps. Create a CCC or its equivalent. Do something that's going to... And they say, what about the deficit, Warren? Let's tax the rich some more. Okay?
They're
getting away with murder.
Yeah, the deficit is such a phony issue because it was run up. We know when it was run up, and it was never in the news when it was happening.
I believe
under
the Republicans have run up more deficits than their.
Oh, every time, time. No, the statistics on that.
And
are
by
crazy.
The way, you know, I'm talking to you. I want to be clear about it. I love the name of your show. Because one of the things you'll see in my, I don't know if I wrote about it, is I don't like being slotted.
Right.
And I think there are two fallacies with our liberal, we happy few, listeners to this program as well. And let me say liberals in general. Two big problems. One, they never know when to say stop, that's evil. Bush had no, George W., baseball, Major League Baseball, like, that's bad. You know, he had no problems. He had a five-year-old mind. You know, either or. Well, I'm not saying that. But there are moments. And read Ian Buruma's work on Holland during World War II, where the liberals didn't know how to deal with the Nazis. And they kept saying, well, you know how they are. Have you ever heard of a play called The Firebugs or Beat 'em on the Firebugs?
No.
It's called The Arsonists, played recently in town. It's the same thing. The liberals say, oh, that's the way they are. Meanwhile, they're storing ammunition in houses. And no, that's the way they are. They hear, they read about towns being burned down by arsonists or anarchists. Oh, that's the way they come with a different dialogue. And then the town is blown up. liberals, we happy few, have got to say, that is wrong, and say it strong enough. And the other fellow...
One thing I would point out, interesting, and we're down to really about a minute and a half.
I just want to make one more point about the liberal...
But it's interesting. You say, don't neglect compromise, but set a line somewhere.
Absolutely. The second thing is beautiful quest for perfection. Obama is clearly not perfect. God, I can go on. But you know what? Compare him to what McCain would be doing now. Compared to whom? That's what you got to say about what's going on. We're going through right now a president who's trying to deal with the fetid detritus that was left him, that I wasn't sure was ever reparable, on his desk. So let's give the guy a break, and let's also not settle for this collusion of going nowhere.
Okay. So I think we're going to wrap it there. The thing that I... that we left out of here is what's happened to, and I'm just going to say, you don't have time to respond, is what happens in the business world too. Mm-hmm. How has the greed and the subterfuge and there are exceptions, but overall where has the leadership there that says, line up, let's serve the greater good. And I you don't have time to respond, but it's
no,
something.
No, I'm not going to respond. Say, get me on your show again.
Okay.
Because I'm very taken with this, because I think the restoring the honor of even business education is very important to me.
Okay. We'll do that, and we'll focus just on that.
Okay.
So again, the book is Still Surprised, A Memoir of a Life in Leadership. The website is warrenbennis.com. That's Warren and then Bennis, B-E-N-N-I-S. You can listen to this week's conversation and any others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do that either at iTunes or at terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net. You can also sign up at that website or by emailing me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally, at mac.com to get a weekly email in which I tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and give you some background on those issues. And then you know what podcast you just missed that you can then find. Thank you, Warren Bennis. Keep up the good work.